Layoffs became a mass phenomenon in American life about 2 decades ago. Until then, writes Louis Uchitel, companies tried to avoid layoffs. They were a sign of corporate failure and a violation of acceptable business behavior. In Uchitel's new book, The Disposable American, he examines how layoffs became standard management practice and what the consequences have been. Uchitel is an economics reporter for The New York Times. He describes 3 myths that have been used to justify layoffs. For example, corporations promised that layoffs would eventually have a payoff for America.
The idea of a payoff for America is that on the horizon, once we get our companies efficient, the layoffs will stop and we will reach an equilibrium in which everyone has job security again. And that was a promise that was much stated 10 or 15 years ago. It has never been realized because the layoffs go on. In fact, they seem to get more frequent as the years pass, and the promised equilibrium in which layoffs stop in a very efficient society never materializes or has not materialized.
Let me get to something else that you say is a myth, and that is that laid off workers must save themselves, that they've lost their job because their value to their employers was less than their cost in wages and benefits, so they must raise their value with more education and training. Why is that a myth?
Well, what we have embraced in America is an individualism. And it says, in effect, people, as the global economy or the more efficient and the more computerized economy comes into place, people have to equip themselves to deal with it. And if they don't, or if they're in jobs that don't require skill, they're subject to losing the jobs. But all they have to do is avail themselves of education and training, and they will equip themselves to be to qualify for the good jobs that are out there. The myth in this is that there aren't enough good jobs out there for all the qualified people. But we like the thought that education and training will re-equip you for another job and give you the promised security in the workforce. It's politically easier to deal with. It takes the government off the hook. It takes unions off the hook, for that matter, and it certainly takes the companies off the hook. You blame the worker.
Another statement that you say is a myth, and that is the pros and cons of layoffs are entirely measurable in dollars and cents. You write in your book, you were actually surprised to find how great the psychological costs of layoffs are.
Yes. When I started this book, I did not expect to find so much psychological damage. People are are interpreting a layoff in America today as a statement that they lack value, and it's a considerable blow to self-esteem. We all have a sort of a life narrative that feeds into our sense of ourselves. Work is one of them, and this declaration that you don't have value destroys that, and as various psychiatrists have told me, it triggers sort of dormant personality traits that would lay dormant all your life if you didn't have this sort of a traumatic trigger, if you will.
In looking how we got to the point that we're at today, where layoffs are so large and so common, you go back to 1981 and you look at the air traffic controller strike. Why do you think that strike is a turning point in the history of American layoffs?
It was one of the barriers that I mentioned to layoffs was the idea that you could go out on strike and have your job back when the strike was finally settled. You didn't have to be afraid to go out on strike because you would be replaced with a replacement, with someone who took your job permanently. And that barrier came down with Reagan's decision in 1981 to replace 11,000 striking air traffic controllers in one fell swoop and replace them with people who were new to the industry. And those air traffic controllers never came back. It was a trauma for the union movement. Almost immediately afterwards, the number of strikes declined because Reagan had in effect announced that replacement workers who were technically legal, they could be hired legally to permanently replace strikers, but no company had dared to do that or had done it very infrequently. There was a norm against it. Reagan broke that norm with that decision, and it was one of the turning points. It was one of the barriers that came down and opened the way to acquiescence to layoffs.
Something else that you note in the same year is that Jack Welch became the head of GE, 1981. You described GE as the company that invented the modern American layoff. What do you mean?
Well, Jack Welch came in with a very interesting concept. He saw that he couldn't compete with every overseas supplier of the products that General Electric made. So he decided that he would keep the companies that did the best, that were the most profitable, spin off or sell the companies that were the least profitable, and acquire companies that looked like they had a good future to them. And he just, every time he acquired or sold some operation, there were layoffs. It helped to pay for the layoffs because money had to be borrowed or very often to fund the layoffs, and it was a way of adjusting staff. And he was successful with General Electric with this acquisition and merger activity. And because he was successful, he became a model for other companies that also got into this buying and selling of companies. And that was another barrier down. But the people who paid for those acquisitions, for the debt that was often floated, were the workers whose salaries were cut, labor costs were cut, and the money channeled, if you will, into the costs of the acquisition.
My guest is Louis Uchitel. His new book is called The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Louis Uchitel. He's an economics writer for The New York Times, and his new book is called The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. Now, cities tried to lure big corporations to set up headquarters or factories in their areas because it's good jobs, it's good for the economy. And that's what Indianapolis tried to do when it lured United Airlines to build an aircraft maintenance center there. And Indianapolis was actually competing with over 90 other cities. Indianapolis won. United, you know, opened up this maintenance center there. So what did Indianapolis have to do to compete well enough to get United to choose their city?
All right, well, keep in mind first that United had decided to build this maintenance center. Having decided, it went out and said, well, what's the best deal we can get from the various competing cities? The best deal they could get was Indianapolis, and with the contribution of the city and the state, Indianapolis and Indiana, which put up well over $250 million floating a bond issue, and which turned out to be nearly half the cost of the maintenance center. And in short, United, having decided to build the maintenance center, got a bunch of cities to compete and got one of the cities, Indianapolis, to bid enough to pay for almost half the center.
And what did Indianapolis think it was going to get out of this?
The promise from United, a sort of commitment, was that there would be more than 5,000 mechanics jobs created, aviation mechanics, never mind the other jobs. These were in those days middle class jobs, and Indianapolis was looking forward to the infusion of more than 5,000 mechanics living with their families, middle class lives. That's quite a bit of support for the city.
What did Indianapolis get out of it?
They got, in the best moment, 2,500 mechanics living in the city and the suburbs, spending their money, enriching the economy. And then
that was about half of what they were expecting.
That was half of what they were expecting. And it was at that point, there were a labor dispute developed between United and its mechanics. And what had been going extremely well turned and went in the other direction.
And United eventually shut down that center. So what was the lesson to you in terms of cities luring companies through financial incentives?
I think it's money wasted. It's close to $30 billion a year that we spend on what amounts to a zero-sum game. For the nation as a whole, it didn't make any difference whether the jobs were in Indianapolis or in Denver or in some other city that bid for the maintenance center. The jobs would have existed one way or the other. And what we've done then is divert tax money to a zero-sum game, tax money that should be spent on teachers and schools and other services. I think I once figured out that you could hire, I don't know how many thousands of teachers for the amount of money that we spend, $30 billion a year. All the communities in America spend competing with each other trying to get good jobs.
We hear a lot about the global economy, and a lot of economies have moved their plants to other countries. A lot of companies have outsourced part of their operations, whether that's 800-number phone calls or typing or reading MRIs. Do you think that's driving down the wages of the people in America who remain employed?
Well, it's a factor, but we shouldn't let it get out of hand. If you were to the actual number of, they call it offshoring, jobs that have actually that have left the country while it's rising and rising rather rapidly is still much smaller than the outsourcing that takes place within the country. That is to the south, to less expensive cities, or they don't go, or there's no outsourcing at all. There are arrangements made with people to keep their jobs in a community, in a plant, but at a lower wage. Caterpillar is an example of that, the two-tier wage. The veterans continue to get the old wage until they retire, and the new people come in at a much lower scale. And that's going on not just at Caterpillar, but in the auto industry, it's going on regularly in Michigan, in many small parts companies that are represented by the UAW. The quid pro quo is that the UAW keeps its membership.
Well, you know, another example of very well-educated people being laid off is in your industry, the newspaper industry. There's been so many layoffs in newspapers. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, in part a lot of reporters who are very well-educated, who are very good at what they do and are losing their jobs. What's it like to see what you're writing about hit your own industry?
It's not fun. It's not fun to see. I must say the New York Times goes at this as well as anyone does. It works through buyouts as much as possible, and they are voluntary buyouts. The Guild comes in and helps negotiate the nature of the buyouts so that, for the most part, the people who are leaving are people who more or less want to leave. It's still disconcerting, but I've written a book that is not about stopping layoffs. I can't do that. The global economy is not to be denied. Our hegemony that we once had that allowed us to have any number of workers is gone, and there is competition. But on the margin, we've gone too far. We've made layoffs too commonplace, too easy, and in the process, we have not, as a people, said, now, look, we have this situation. We can't employ everybody. How do we do it? How do we take every stakeholder into account? And that's what we're not doing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this very much.
Louis Uchitel is an economics reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called The Disposable American.